Welcome back to the Epic Universal Podcast. I'm entertainment writer Jim Hill, and I'm joined today by my co-host Eric Hersey, and he and I are recording this week's episode on Saturday, April 13th. And Eric, you know, speaking of the 13th tonight at Universal Orlando, they're holding their second grad bash of the year. Are you aware of this thing? The thing they do for high school seniors in Florida and Georgia?
Well, you know, Jim, I know it exists. As for, you know, I didn't live in Florida or Georgia when I graduated, so I'm not too sure how that works for them. I mean, I guess the local one here, I could have went to Kennywood in Pittsburgh, but that wasn't on my, I guess, calling card when I graduated.
What they typically do is it's actually sort of grows out of Disney's grad night, which is something I want to say that got started back in the 60s. And the idea is it's a safe graduation event. You know, typically what happens is high school students get bussed down from cities in Florida or Georgia or the like. And what they do is they have the two Universal parks in Florida, Islands and, of course, the studios, to themselves from 7 p.m. to 2 a.m. And this year, the first one was held on April 12th. And again, second one's being held tonight on the 13th. And then the three remaining ones on the calendar are April 19th, April 20th, and April 26th. And so you went to Kennywood? You
know, Okay. I did not go to Kennywood. That would be the closest I could if they wanted to bus us up. I don't know if they have something like that local here. But that's our local theme park, so to speak. So no, we didn't quite do that. I did not have a giant celebration or do really anything fun. I think I just went straight to technical college and like, all right, we're going to make these websites. And I was like, I don't want to pay anything. So they gave us a scholarship and they were like, no time off. You start in the summer. So that's.
Wow. Okay. Well, if it's any consolation, I graduated high school in 77 and we were kind of in the same space. I think you know, our idea of excitement is we knocked over a butter churn, you know, just sort of like, you know, and we were basically Amish and you know, in Maynard, Massachusetts. But anyway, all right, we got a lot of stuff to cover today on the show, folks, so we're going to get right to it. But first and foremost, want to acknowledge our sponsor, and today's show is sponsored by TouringPlans.com. Touring Plans helps you save time and money at theme parks like Universal Studios and also those parks over at the Disney Place. So please go check them out at touringplans.com. All right. So, folks, as we mentioned at the top of the show, it's April, that month where, thanks to Earth Day, which is on April 22nd, likewise Arbor Day, April 26th is here. I guess we're all supposed to grab a trowel or a shovel and then head outside and plant something. And mind you, our friends at Universal, they'd like to remind you when you go to dig that hole in the backyard, you know, maybe make it 6 feet deep, just because you never know when you're going to have to hide a body or two. Okay, that's Eric and my way of mentioning that tickets to the 2024 edition of Halloween Horror Night Orlando went on sale just last week on Thursday, April 4th. So did you eyeball the schedule at all, Eric? Or?
Yeah, it does look like they actually opened it up a little early this year, right? Or there's more dates, I should say, more dates earlier in the calendar. So
you're right on both counts that this is the first time ever that Halloween Horror Nights, at least the Orlando edition, has gotten underway in August. It starts on Friday, August 30th this year. You're also correct about, you know, more dates. It's 44 dates this year. And as a result, it will last longer than any Halloween Horror Night on record. It's going to go all the way till Sunday, November 3rd. Single-day tickets are now on sale, starting at $76. On the other hand, if you want to be among the first to sample this year's mazes, get ready to pony up $102.99. People are already sort of, they don't know what the themes of the maze are, and, you know, there's been lots of speculation online, but I think one of the things that's most interesting, Eric, is people are wondering what's Universal going to do to top last year's viral hit? And that was the Megan Horde. And have you seen this yet, the Megan Horde?
Well, Jim, I know of Megan the movie. I believe I was in the theaters. It might have been Ant-Man Quantumania it was in front of. I don't know, but I was sitting there with my kids, and I recall seeing the trailer, and that was probably one of the most freaky, like, I didn't know anything about it, and you're like, hold on, what was that? A real-life doll? So, yeah, that's kind of terrifying.
Well, and you're not wrong. And the movie that Eric's referring to, Universal's Megan, opened at theaters January of last year, and it was about a child-sized humanoid robot who's powered by AI, who ends up being gifted to this sad little 8-year-old girl who's just lost her parents in a car accident. And Eric, it starts out so hopeful and promising, and then in the great Hollywood tradition, something goes horribly wrong. And don't want to give any too much away here, but look, Megan is a horror film, so you do the math, people. Okay, Megan only cost Universal $12 million to make, goes on to make $181 million worldwide, does so well at the box office, Eric. Before the second weekend, Universal announces that they are making a Megan sequel. In fact, again, given the field you work in, you'll love this. It's Megan 2.0.
Oh, I love it. Absolutely.
Okay, but here's the thing. One of the reasons that Universal, anyway, believes that the original Megan was such a big hit last year was that the Megan character, again, that child-sized humanoid doll powered by AI, became a viral sensation, largely because a lot of folks tried to imitate the dance that Megan does during that movie. And so, all right, back now to the Megan Horde. All right, so picture this, Eric. You're standing in the streets of Universal Studios at this after-hours hard tech ticket event, and suddenly six young girls who are all dressed identically as the Megan character, right? Because again, the idea was that, in fact, the whole conceit of the original Megan movie is this: the doll was a prototype for something that was going to be mass produced. The idea that every child in America was going to have a Megan doll as their new artificial friend, like a Cabbage Patch Kid or an American Girl doll. Anyway, all six of these young girls, all of them dressed as Megan, suddenly appear in the street, and then in flash mob fashion, they as a group begin performing the dance Megan did in the movie, but all in perfect sync. And seriously, you can go on YouTube right now and watch hundreds of videos of this thing, because people, as soon as these characters appeared, it's like, oh my God, it's Megan, let me my phone. Everybody loved it. So now, where this gets especially interesting is that one of the reasons that Universal believes that Megan was as big a hit as it was that they deliberately went after the little girl audience. 2022, before the movie arrived in theaters, when Universal took Megan to the MPAA, those are the folks who determine the ratings for movies, and they handed them an R, Universal actually reshot portions of the original Megan to guarantee that they got their PG-13, which meant that at least kids who were 13 and older could get in and see this thing. Anyway, back to Megan 2 or Megan 2.0. Again, when Universal initially announced that they were going to do a sequel, it's like, okay, we'll put it out into theaters in the exact same time, Eric, that, you know, they were going to put it out in January of 2025. But this thing made so much money and was such a viral sensation. They made the decision just a few months after that to slide the release date up into May of 2025. Because to Universal's way of thinking, this is, you know, this could be one of our summer blockbusters. So let's move it into summer blockbuster season.
Right. But I think it all depends on what new dance they're going to have, Jim. That's going to ultimately be the success. What new thing is she going to pull out this year?
Well, again, you're not wrong. I've actually been hearing that, you know, that was one of the discussions when they were developing the script. It's like, what can we virally walk out of this thing? Now, toward that end, though, Universal, you know, looked at, you know, the success of Megan and said, okay, Scary Little Girls. All right. What can we do with Scary Little Girls? Which brings us to the movie that Universal is opening this Friday, April 19th. Abigail, have you seen any of the?
Oh, Jim. I just watched the trailer. Let me just tell you this. I don't think it's PG-13.
No. In fact, you are correct that this is, again, don't want to give away too much here. It's about, the setup for the film is that Abigail is a 12-year-old ballerina prodigy, but she's also the daughter of a very wealthy underworld figure. And this group of amateur criminals decide, oh, you know, we're going to kidnap this girl and hold her for ransom and demand that her daddy give us $50 million. And so they grab Abigail, they go to a remote mansion, they contact the dad. And it's only then when they're there that they begin to realize that Abigail maybe isn't your average little girl, that perhaps she's something that feasts on blood and flesh. And we won't get into it, but Eric's not wrong that because of the sort of horror film this is, again, the Universal went to the MPAA, and you know, it was one of these things where it's, guys, I'm really sorry. I know you want a PG-13. This is an R, and you can reshoot all you want, but you're still going to get an R. You know, in fact, the on the poster, there's literally a line that explains that it was given the rating that it was due to strong bloody violence and gore throughout, which, you know, tells you right there, not a musical.
No.
Okay. But here to bring this all full circle, the interesting thing is, while Universal has sort of resigned themselves to, like, well, within our, we're not going to do Megan size business. But on the other hand, Abigail, you know, already what's interesting is the folks who do the mazes for Halloween Horror Night are like, oh, this is going to make a great maze. So, you know, maybe not this year, maybe next year, because again, Universal is going to want to see what Abigail actually does at the box office before they commit. But don't be surprised if, you know, the Megan whore returns to dance, and that, you know, after you see that, maybe you go get in line for the Abigail maze. So.
Right. It's all about creepy little girls, I guess, is what's
there we go.
Drive the mazes. So it'll be exciting to see. It looks like an interesting movie.
We'll see. Okay. So now I guess it's time for news or not, right?
Right. Well, I think there was a couple of items of news, and especially I think we got blasted. Maybe it was this Friday. I can't recall. There was the emails. I was smart enough, Jim. It's only taken me 3 or 4, 5, 6 episodes. I went to Universal and signed up for their newsletter. I said, we'll sign up and we'll get the news in so they can spam me all they want now. And one of the items that I got was essentially that the two new hotels opening at Universal Orlando in early 2025. So kind of jumped into a rabbit hole and really would like your opinion on these. The names of those are the Universal Stella Nova Resort and the Universal Terra Luna Resort. And they did accompany, I think, it had a 2-minute video flyover, nice little music, you know, artist renderings and so forth. Did you have a chance to kind of virtually tour these two resorts?
I did. And again, for me, what's intriguing, you know, and again, Stella Nova opens January of next year. And then just a few weeks later, the Terra Luna opens. They're both moderates with 750 rooms each. So when they both come online, what is it? That's 1,500 rooms. And then we have our high-end Helios, which is actually in the Epic Universe Park. That'll have 500 rooms. So that adds 2,000 to the overall resort. And Eric and I were pre-gaming before we got started recording here today, folks. And I can't help but look backwards at, you know, for example, when Cabana Bay opened. And in fact, it 10 years ago, this spring, phase one opened March of 2014 with 950 family suites. And the second half of that wouldn't open until May of 2017 with 1,250 standard rooms. These are the towers that are adjacent to Volcano Bay. So a total number of rooms coming online at that point was 2,200. But this was, again, Universal's first moderate, you know, aimed at the family. And, you know, and for me, it's hard not to look at Universal going forward with that and what Disney did back in 2012 when they took the legendary years side of
classic years, maybe
classic years.
Yeah.
All right. Okay. The uncompleted side of Pop Century, and then turned that into Art of Animation, which I had 984 standard rooms and then 1,120 family suites to add over 2,100 rooms to, you know. But again, same idea, going after the moderate market. And have you and the family stayed there before?
We have a couple different times. Little Mermaid, hanging out down there with the giant Ursula statue. So yeah, we've stayed there a couple times, different rooms, ventured all around.
And was that your vibe, looking at the flyovers and the animation and the video for Stella Nova and Terra Luna?
Yeah, I think you know, you can tell with a lot of the design aesthetics that's going on nowadays. If this was built back when Art Animation, you would have probably saw that design style. Like, it just, they come off very much as like a higher end value, like you would say a moderate. The theming here is based off of what, you know, the sun, the moon. I got a very Doctor Who vibe. I'm like, all right, this is
okay.
This is TARDIS stuff. You go in the, you know, but it's real sleek, but yet not, no, you know, hard, rough surfaces and edges. It's more linear stuff. So, but I very fascinated by how many rooms are being opened up and just the overall hotel game over in Universal. It's interesting. I even had a friend that just went down a couple months ago and they stayed at Universal, but went to the Disney parks. So I think there is a part of people that's saying, hey, I think the value in the Universal resorts are there and there's some occupancy and the theming and it's clean. So I think that they're taking some, you know, I guess, dollars from Disney by opening up some of these. And I think they continue to do that.
Oh, no, absolutely. I mean, for example, Endless Summer, with, you know, the first part of that hotel opened in June of 2019 with 750 rooms, and second half, December of 2020, Dockside with, 2,500 or total 2,800 rooms added to the overall resort. But, I flat out told by folks at Universal that they were going to operate Endless Summer at a loss with the notion of people would stay there and go to Disney, which meant that they'd get their breakfast in the morning, they'd get their dinner at night, they would do, you know, before they got on the plane, their last bit of souvenir shopping would be in the Universal shop. And the notion was, we make it clean, we make it modern, and, you know, people have, you know, a good time and say, I want to go back there. And so, long term, that pays off, that, you know, these people get in the habit of staying at a Universal resort and go driving over to Disney for the day. But, you know, if they're there at Universal, chances are we'll get them in our parks, we'll get them at the water park.
Well, get the kids seeing the IP and saying, oh, I didn't know this. Because, you know, kids don't know what they don't know. They don't, you know, they typically don't go search online what other options there are. They go to where their parents take them. But if they see there's a Trolls or Minions and they're like, hold on, what's this? I think it's a genius. And I looked at the prices today and, I mean, they have hotels still under $100. And that's not happening in Disney. I can tell.
No, that is not happening. But again, for me, what was fascinating was if you cold-bloodedly look at, you know, think about it. When Islands opened and the Universal went from one theme park to two theme parks and became, destination resorts. That's when you saw, you know, that's when they opened the Hard Rock and Portobello and the Royal Pacific. But then things stalled out for a while, hotel-wise, and it's only in the past 10 years that we've seen Cabana Bay, Sapphire Falls, Aventura. They added 6,600 hotel rooms on site in that window of time. And now here we are with the next 2,000 opening, you know, right, directly adjacent to the brand new park. I mean, it just, it's ambitious. It's very, very ambitious. So,
and there's lots of competition down in Orlando. It's not like there's not other places to stay. So it's insane how many hotel rooms and everything opened up over the years. But I will tell you, I would love to try them. You know, they sold me enough. It is interesting. It's totally different than what I'm used to in many aspects of Disney, like, you know, big characters. There's no giant, hockey net or giant Roger Rabbit. But I'll give it a go. I certainly will.
I don't know. But it's interesting you bring up Big News and the Mouse, because, you know, we have to, at least touch on the Daz news that just came out of Disney, largely because what's kind of interesting is the outfit that Disney's about to get in bed with to do the verification about whether or not people will be allowed to get into the assistance line, you know, it's the same outfit that does it for the Universal Parks, right?
Right. And it's essentially also Six Flags, and it just seems like it's been universally adopted. So I know very little, and I'll be very upfront. I know very little about the DAS program. We've not utilized. We called once thinking that's when my wife broke her foot and we were going to put her in a wheelchair. We thought that's what we did. Turns out that is not the case. Of, you know, you were treated just as if you were, you know, if you're in a wheelchair, you're waiting in line for most of the rides. DAS is a totally different thing. And it seemed like for the longest time, Disney, and until just now, they had it kind of in their own, they wanted more control over it, right? Where it seems like other theme parks, Universal included, wanted to involve a third party, which is the IBCCES accessibility card. And the whole process there is that you go through them and they make the decision, and then you work directly with Universal to what they get their accessibility card. So overall, it's interesting just to see how this is all furring over in Disney. But I mean, I was interested in hearing of those out there that's used it for Universal, because I think this is a good way to see how that's going to go on the other side. Is it an easy process? Is it something that you guys have used? So I honestly, I don't want to speak too much on it, because I'm not, you know, I can only read about it, but I want to hear anybody out there reach out to us and let us know what kind of problems are we going to see? Where's the pros and cons from what they've dealt with?
That is an excellent idea. I had not thought of that. No, folks, quite seriously, if we could follow up on Eric's suggestion here, those of you who've actually used, you know, the Universal equivalent of guest DAS, if you could reach out and let us know what it was like. We'd love to get your take on it, because obviously this is just coming over the hill over at the Mouse House, and it might be nice to gauge people's responses to how things were handled at Universal to be aware of what's coming now for Disney. No, that's a great idea, Rick. Wow, cool. Well, all right. Anyway, folks, that brings us to the end of the news portion of the show. We're going to take a quick break here. But after that, as I think we mentioned on our previous show for this month, we're going to take a look at things Kong-related. But first, this. And we're back. Before we get started here, Eric, you were mentioning out ahead of the topic we'll be discussing here today. You sat your family down to watch the 1933 version of King Kong, right? The one that was animated by Willis O'Brien, stop motion, all that?
Oh yeah, yeah. It's a classic. I remember watching it when I was young. I don't know when. I don't know, but I certainly remember watching it at some point in time. And this Friday night, we got ourselves some pizza, and I said, I said we're gonna watch King Kong. And then we found that it is streaming. I believe it was Max. You know, I have the new cable, which is every single streaming service. So you just have to find out where you find it. But we sat down and we watched the and I live tweeted the whole thing. So I gave opinions. So if you want to hear what a 7-year-old and a 13-year-old, head over to at Eric Hersey on X, and you'll get all the opinions. And yes, she did believe that they filmed everything in black and white, including the trees. I said, no, that's not how that works. They didn't paint tree leaves black and white. So this is all fun. She didn't think she could make it, but we made it through. But that's okay. That's not the most exciting Kong, right, Jim? There's other Kongs out there, probably something that's more relevant.
No, it's worth noting that, yes, just for example, this past weekend, Godzilla Kong, the new Empire, was at the top of the box office, second weekend in theaters, sold $31 million worth of tickets. And to date in North America, this Warner Brothers film has made $134 million overseas, $226 million. So worldwide box office of $365 million. And of course, it's out there this weekend making dough as well. And again, that's not bad box office for a 91-year-old ape, you know. And but as we mentioned, you know, the very film that Eric sat his family down to watch came out. In fact, it's 91 years this month. April 7th, 1933 is when King Kong first opened in theaters. And, you know, I would argue that one is the best Kong. And there have been a number of remakes over the past 60 years. With the first, the Toho-produced King Kong versus Godzilla. What's kind of interesting, Eric, is that was released in Japan, August of 1962. And then Universal, of all studios, acquires the American distribution rights. And then they created the American dubbed version. So, oh my God, look, a giant lizard.
right.
Anyway, okay, so as for the first really for real Hollywood remake of this classic monster movie, that would be the King Kong that Paramount Pictures released to theaters back in December of 1976. Now, Eric, you're going to love this, but it was Michael Eisner, who at the time, by the way, was just a lowly executive at ABC Television. He sees the very version of King Kong you showed your family Friday last in December of 1974. And he thinks, ooh, this would be a good movie to remake with the sort of visual effects Hollywood can do today. So the then just 32-year-old Michael Eisner, who desperately wants to get out of television and start making movies, so he reaches out to a number of people in Hollywood and pitches his remake King Kong with modern visual effects ideas to a number of the town's movers and shakers. And among them is Sid Sheinberg, the CEO and president of MCA Universal Pictures, but also Barry Diller, who's the CEO of Paramount Pictures. And where this starts to go wrong is that both of these very powerful men think that remaking King Kong with modern visual effects is a great idea. And Sid Sheinberg is especially keen on this idea because just a month earlier, November of 74, Universal had sent Earthquake out into theaters as a showcase for the studio's brand new sense-around system. Do you, Eric, are you familiar at all with sense-around?
You know, I couldn't pronounce it. I was reading it. I'm like, I'm not even sure what this is. How to say this? No, I do not know. But what was that?
Okay, here's the idea. You go into a movie theater, all right? But you know, and you're sitting, but you look on either side of the screen, and there's this giant bank of speakers.
Oh,
and it's like, okay, that's unusual. And so they start the movie, and so you know, for the whole movie, the sound is normal, the music is normal, but now it comes time for the earthquake. And what they do is they turn on this set of speakers to stun. And so as you're sitting there in your seat, you're now being hammered with sound waves. I mean, you could literally feel this in your chest.
Oh my.
you know, and don't get me wrong, you know, I have to tell folks right up front, if you go out and watch the movie that Universal put out there to sell the world on Sense Around Earthquake, it is cheesy, doesn't even begin to describe it. All right. You know, you know, that this movie should have been produced by the Kraft Corporation. All right. But on the other hand, all right, it took them $6 million to make it. Eric, it made $167 million worldwide, which, by the way, that's over $1 billion in 2024 dollars. And I know that because I went to the Bureau of Labor Statistics official inflation calculator to get that number. So
now, Jim, is this when all those movies like the, you know, Earthquake and Towering Inferno, is this like when it was real popular?
Oh, yeah, no. You've nailed it. You know, this is Poseidon Adventure started in 72. Towering Inferno came. And yes, Universal wanted to get into the disaster business. So this is why they did Earthquake as well. So, but again, so obviously people wanted to see, you know, enjoyed Sense Around. It made box office. So Universal wanted to make another Sense Around movie and fast. And Sheinberg, what he wanted to make was The Legend of King Kong. And what Sid envisioned, a remake still set in the 30s, still has our giant ape, you know, making his way to New York, climbing the Empire State Building, battling biplanes. But and by the way, he also, you know, it's like we got to stick with what works. So it's like we're going to do stop motion. And so but at that time, they were thinking they'd recruit Ray Harryhausen, who, by the way, had been, you know, studied under Willis O'Brien, the guy who literally did the first Kong. And so, but what would have made this different is The Legend of King Kong. It would have been shot in color. It would have been widescreen. And of course, it would have featured Sense Around. So every time Kong roared or pounded his chest, you would have felt it in your chest as you sat out in the audience. But again, we mentioned just one problem. With Sid's plan, Barry Diller really liked Michael Eisner's idea. And Paramount's legal team had moved faster than MCA Universal's legal team. They contacted RKO. They're the studio who made the original Kong in 33 and acquired the movie rights. And you know, the folks over at Paramount, very different vision of Kong. They wanted to set it in the modern day. In fact, this one was going to be so modern, Kong wouldn't climb the Empire State Building. He was going to climb the World Trade Center, which, by the way, Eric, had only just opened in April of 1973. Right. And then when he was up there, he was supposed to jump from tower to tower. And
We couldn't have got both of them, huh?
Well, now it's so interesting you say that, because Sidney Sheinberg, it's like, now wait a minute. You know, he's like, I called the folks at RKO. We had a verbal agreement that we had the rights to make King Kong, you know, and it wound up in court. In fact, it wasn't till December of 1976, literally 11 days before this movie, by the way, Paramount immediately put their version into production.
Okay.
And in fact, to make sure that they'd get out there first, they made the decision, stop motion takes a lot of time. So let's go with a guy in a suit. You know, in fact, it was Rick Baker, you know, the master makeup guy who actually wound up in the suit playing Kong. By the way, you'll love this. Because you love Disney, you love animatronics. You have to Google King Kong animatronics, because they actually built, I want to say it's a 65-foot tall mechanical Kong that never worked. You know, I mean, I think in the film, okay, you get to see this thing in action for seconds, because, you know, they there's a great story about Paramount shooting its version of Kong with a stadium full of people who are, you know, instead of Kong being in a theater in chains, he's in, like, I want to say Yankee Stadium.
Okay.
And, you know, and the notion was that, you know, so it's Kong in a cage, and but the animatronic Kong was supposed to break out, and people in the stadium were supposed to panic and run off. And the people who were in the event described the fact that they went to fire up the Kong, and a hose blew. So all the hydraulics were malfunctioning, but not only did the hose blew in a very unfortunate place, Eric, you know, okay. So for a lot of people sitting in the stands, it's like, does Kong need a bathroom break? Cause you know, am I seeing what I'm saying? You know, anyway. All right. Long story short, Paramount rushes its version into production. This ends up in court just days before Paramount gets out. And the judge makes the determination. It's like, look, all right, we're going to have to do some further study here. But, you know, he's going to make a Solomon-like decision. It's like, I believe you both have the rights. So what's going to happen is, you know, I decree that 18 months after the Paramount version comes out, Universal has the rights to release its version, the Legend of King Kong. Unfortunately, Paramount version cost $24 million to make, only makes $91, which means it turns a profit, Eric. But it's not nearly as much money as I think any of the parties involved here thought it would.
Sure.
And as a result of which, Universal's like, do we really need to make the Legend of King Kong? You know, in fact, they pivot to another Sensaround project, the Midway. It's basically... it's set during World War II. It's a crucial battle in the Pacific. And again, because there were lots of aircraft carriers firing off cannons, it's a perfect project for Sensaround. All right. Anyway, what ends up happening is this court case does continue to chug along till 1983. And at that point, a judge determines, well, look, as far as I'm concerned, looking over the you know, I think the previous judge was wrong. I think only Universal has the film rights to King Kong. In fact, and where this got especially interesting is when Paramount decided to finally make a sequel to their King Kong, King Kong Lives. They actually had to go to Universal and pay them for the rights to make the sequel. But, you know, but here's Universal at the end of this rather expensive, lengthy court case. And they're like, we have the film rights. Do we want to make a Kong movie? It's like, well, no, not necessarily. It's like, well, what other rights did we get with this? And it's like, well, theme park rights. Do we want to do anything with Kong at the theme park? And it was like, ooh. And Eric, you have to understand that in the same window of time, middle 1980s, they are in the process of developing Universal City, Florida, which was the original name of the theme park, that they were going to build. And it's like, oh, we could do a King Kong attraction. Ooh, this could be interesting. So, Universal turns to top companies in the industry. They go to Landmark. They go to Sequoia Creative. By the way, Sequoia Creative is the company that Bob Gurr, who I know you know from your love of Disney, the guy who developed the Autopia, who did a lot of the mechanical stuff at Disney. This is the company that Bob set up after he left Imagineering for a while. Landmark and Sequoia were tasked with what could you do with Kong? But at the same time, what was interesting is that Universal for a time is looking at what it's going to cost to build a theme park in Florida. It's like, wow, that is more money than we're willing to spend. We need a financial partner. And, well, let's meet with some other studios. Let's see, you know, who they might be in, you know, might be interested in coming in with us, you know, to build in Florida. So who do they meet with? Paramount. All right. And in fact, the what I love about this story is Michael Eisner, who, by the way, when King Kong came out in December of 76, made enough money that Barry Diller said, Michael, thank you, you know, for suggesting that idea. Hey, by the way, you want to leave ABC and come over here and make movies? And so he starts working at Paramount on their movie side. Now we jump ahead. You know, he's been there for about 8 years or thereabouts. Michael ends up being one of the people who goes over to Universal and gets shown every single thing that they're planning on building in Florida, you know, with their
Universal. Allegedly, Jim, right? This is allegedly, correct?
Look, all right. I have had people, I get, you know, the interesting thing is that's the Disney version of the story, that Michael allegedly was at this thing. On the other hand, the Universal people, they could tell me the building, the bungalow on the lower lot where this was held, the Jack, and it was the Jack Webb bungalow. And they said they remember specifically because Michael asked a lot of really smart questions and he made them go through everything with him.
He said that Catastrophe Canyon part. Go over that one more time. Hold on.
But that's the other interesting part of the story. We'll get to the earthquake attraction that they eventually built at Universal. But yeah, that, you know, there was, you know, Catastrophe Canyon. Boy, there's some things in that that look a lot like that Universal earthquake movie. But anyway, all right, yeah, back to Sequoia and Landmark. And what they decide to do is, you know, they sell Universal, especially Hollywood. It's like, this should be part of the tram tour, you know. And in fact, what they do is they have built on the lower lot a 26,000 square foot building that is, you know, it, in fact, it's in the New York section of the, you know, their back lot. And, you know, so your tram pulls up to, you know, a pretty standard looking New York building. The door goes up. You slide inside. Only as soon as you enter the building, Eric, it's nighttime. You're on the elevated subway in New York, and you're rolling by all of these apartments that look like people have vacated them immediately. You know that something big is going on, but there are televisions blaring in all these apartments, and they're talking about Kong is loose in New York City and to take cover. And in fact, you know, a news helicopter flies overhead. You have a quick shot of your own tram. And then, but the news helicopter goes around the corner and then suddenly you hear a roar. And it looks like the same news helicopter has been swatted out of the sky and crashes to the ground and bursts into flames. And now, you know, so you're on this straight piece of track. You go around the corner. And suddenly you find yourself headed on the Brooklyn Bridge. And there, directly ahead of you, hanging onto the cables of the Brooklyn Bridge, is King Kong. And this King Kong, thanks to Bob Gurr, is the largest animatronic of its age. It's 30 feet tall. It's 7 tons. Now, mind you, it's just Kong from kind of the waist up, but he's holding, you know, the Brooklyn Bridge. And now your tram roars, you know, drives onto the bridge, and Kong is 3 feet away from you. And you can smell his banana breath as he shakes the bridge that you're on. And then, you know, the tram driver's, let's get out of here. And you drive out of the building. So, two and a half minute long experience. And by the way, another one of the masterful things that Bob Gurr did, you know, in developing this attraction is, he worked with the folks at Wilkins, to figure out how to make and you have to understand the tram weighs 88,000 pounds, and there's 175 people riding on this thing at any one time. They figured out how to rock the bridge, or make it seem like the bridge was being rocked by Kong.
No, I watched this earlier, Jim. I went through and watched on YouTube, and there's actually a pretty decent little mini documentary that Bob Gurr pops right up. He starts talking.
Yes, so it's yeah.
you could feel like you were there.
No. Universal was justly proud of what they'd done, and you're right. They did a lot of publicity at the time because they spent a lot of money on this thing. This addition to the tram tour all by itself cost $6.5 million. Now, mind you, again, it's only 2.5 minutes long, and what's kind of interesting about the design is. Again, you go into that 26,000 square foot building, but it's a U-shaped piece of track. So your tram goes in, you get the scene with the abandoned apartments and the television that give you all the exposition you need. But what you don't realize is on the other side of the U-shaped track is another tram that is now, you know, on the Brooklyn Bridge being shaken by our giant animatronic, a Kong. And so anyway, you know, just, you know, they, but it, like you said, that, you know, they did a lot of publicity. They did this documentary because, you know, it's like we spent a lot of money. We have to make this work. And so Sheinberg was so determined that this would be an event out ahead of the opening of this thing, which, by the way, opened June of 1986. Space on hundreds of billboards around the Los Angeles area, you know, to the effect of you could not know that the King Kong Encounter was opening at Universal that summer. And it paid off big time, Eric. Paid attendance to Universal Studios Hollywood that summer jumped from previous year had been 4.2 million in 1985. In 1986, it was 5.1 million. You know, that's my, how many people were like, I have to go to Universal. I have to go see this Kong thing. And what was so fascinating about this is that had such an impact on attendance, you know, at the Universal Studios Hollywood Park, that Sid Sheinberg was like, oh, we got to do this again. We got to come up with, you know, same thing. We got to add something new to the tram that make people think, I got to go back to Universal. I got to sample it. And so using the Kong Encounter playbook, they decide to build a Earthquake, the big one, which, again, same thing, you know, build a brand new. In fact, I want to say they tore down their old English castle in the lower lot to create stage 50 that you would roll into. And the idea is it was a recreation of a subway station up in San Francisco. And, you know, you rolled into that space and suddenly they did this artificial recreation of an 8.3 earthquake. And, you know, and suddenly water comes cascading down. The road above you separates and this giant oil tanker slides you in your direction and bursts into flames. I mean, it was an amazing bit of stagecraft. And by the way, one of the reasons we're bringing this up is Earthquake, the big one, closed at Universal Studios Hollywood March of last year for refurbishing. And later this month, as part of the 60th anniversary, in fact, the opening date for this new version, it is April 26th, and they just did a preview of the newly refurbished, beautiful looking new version of the Earthquake ride, which has a lot of the classic illusions and some new stuff we're checking out. But and anyway, sort of bring this full circle back to Orlando and Michael Eisner, the success of the Kong scene and the earthquake scene in Hollywood made the folks who were working on Universal's project for Florida think, well, we have to do these down here in Orlando. But where this got interesting is the decision was made at that time. It's like, you know, let's not do them as scenes in the tram. Let's do full-blown attractions. And at some point in the future, Eric and I will talk about the Florida versions. Speaking of which, I guess that brings us to the end of this week's show. So,
yeah, I love. I love old attractions like this. It makes me, with the whole Florida Hollywood, which one should be the first, like the tram tour kind of earthquake stuff, that's like, oh, I need to see that. So it's wonderful. Thank you for doing all digging up that research and always love hearing some of those stories. So,
well, again, you know, just for me, what I especially love about that era in Universal history is literally how incestuous it was. I mean, you know, again, you know, Michael Eisner's there in the mix, Bob Gurr is there in the mix. You know Disney and Universal were definitely in competition during this period, and the parallels between what we're dealing with right now, the moment that's happening right now, that Universal and Disney once again are coming to blows and being very competitive, and so it's a great time to be, you know, to be talking about this stuff.
I think so. And Jim, if people want to hear more of us talking about this, you can always follow me over on Twitter, Instagram at Eric Hersey. Jim, where can we find you at?
Let's see. Okay. I am on X, Twitter, whatever you call it. Likewise, Instagram is Jim Hill Media, and over on Facebook as Jim Hill Media News. Also want to point out that we have a couple of other podcasts here at Jim Hill Media we'd like you to check out. We, of course, have The Mothership, Disney Dish with Len Testa. We also have Fine Tuning. I do with Drew Taylor, who, by the way, has his own wonderful podcast that he does with Charles Hood, the Light the Fuse, the Mission Impossible, the official Mission Impossible podcast. Also looking at Lucasfilm with Brian Gahn. In fact, Brian was just down at Disneyland checking out their new season of The Force, and we'll be talking about that the next day or so. And of course, we have the show I do with your lovely bride, Lauren. I Want That Too, which is all about Disney merch. In fact, I, as soon as we finish here, I have to go back to work on the feature I'll be doing with Lauren. I think we're recording that tomorrow. And it's actually ties back to a movie that the Muppets almost made, which was Muppets in Space as opposed to Muppets from Space. But you know, and then, of course, we have our brand new-ish video series, Disney Unpacked, which Len and I do with veteran Imagineer Jim Shule. You can find that over at Patreon. And by the way, that's edited and assembled with great care by my co-host, Eric Hersey here. So anyway, I guess on behalf of Mr. Hersey, this is Jim Hill, and we want to thank you for listening to this edition of the Epic Universal Podcast.